This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and thank you for joining us for our radio and streaming Main Street all across North Dakota this time of day. And as we go to our communities all across the state, there's one sort of fixture in most towns of any size, and that's a bank, because, we need to take loans, we need to put our money in savings, we need to do this and that with our money. But there's only one Bank of North Dakota, and by that I mean it's singular in the United States as a public bank that was established for government purposes. To talk about public banking in general and a movement to increase the number of public banks in the United States from one to many, we're talking with Walt McCree. He's the former chair of the Public Banking Institute, and he remains as a senior advisor. He joins us by phone. Walt, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure, Doug.
Well, let's get some background on your organization. What is the Public Banking Institute?
It's about 10 years old, and it's stemmed out of a book that was written by our current chair, Ellen Brown, which was called Web of Debt, which was really kind of an exposition about how money comes into our society and the economy as an instrument of debt and obligation. That book became a bestseller. This was in 2000, around 2008 and 9, which, of course, was at the point where the global banking cartel, if you will, kind of brought the economies of the world down, but and most especially in the United States, where credit dried up in many regards, where foreclosures increased, where all kinds of the bad economic metrics emerged from that period, except, as Ellen Brown noted, in North Dakota. And it was that phenomenon of the resiliency of North Dakota in the midst of the collapse and the drawdown in the 49 other states that she noticed how what that difference was, which was the Bank of North Dakota, at least from how we saw it. Your bank provided a backstop and a resilience and an ability to maintain the credit lines that are so important to local economies that did not occur elsewhere around the country. So the Public Banking Institute became a conversation first out of that. And then in not too long afterwards, through the writings of Ellen, she's a rather prolific writer, people were saying, hey, I think we want some of those banks. And then we started, of course, to note also as derivative of that collapse, that the global banks were not doing us a lot of favors, extracting money from locales and states, and not being very supportive for what the people needed to do. So that began that conversation, which has since grown into about 30 different initiatives, state and municipal initiatives around the country. The Public Banking Institute is an educational group. It's a nonprofit. And so we educate and we consult and we advise so that the elected officials can do something on their own, in their own way, and in their own place.
Well, where I sit in downtown Fargo, I can see four banks. And so there's no shortage of commercial banks in the state of North Dakota. But, of course, that singular state-owned bank is what we're talking about here. So how do you define a public bank? How does it differ?
Yeah. And by the way, what you just mentioned, Doug, is another phenomenon in North Dakota, which we owe to the Bank of North Dakota, which is that the community banks and credit unions in North Dakota are more numerous and more profitable than any other state in the country, in part because of the wonderful architecture of the Bank of North Dakota, which partners with the local financial institutions. And that is a theme that the Public Banking Institute also spreads widely and strongly to reassure our commercial banking partner brethren that this would be a very positive contribution to how they do their business. We describe public banks as those banks that are owned by the people. Commercial banks and private banks have stockholders. And the purpose of those banks, in addition to lending credit into local communities, is to make a profit for their stockholders. So the public bank notion that we subscribe to is that the benefits of the franchise of banking can be shared and deployed for the people and hopefully, like the Bank of North Dakota, generate non-tax revenue for the municipalities and states that have them in place.
So how would this be different, for example, than a cooperative credit union?
Well, it's in many respects very similar. But the money that is in the bank, in the public bank, is the money of the people. It's the tax dollars, the revenue, all sorts of revenues, as you have in North Dakota. By law, all of the public deposits go into BND. And that distinguishes that, as opposed to people bringing their own household dollars and business dollars into that depository.
You know, they're citizens of the state as opposed to members of the union, a credit union, I take it then. Public banking is unusual in the U.S. You've got this one here in North Dakota, but it is relatively common around the world. That said, bank privatization is taking hold around the world, isn't it?
Well, that's an interesting topic because it really exposes the a lot of aspects of how power is concentrated in the banking industry. And what we've seen, there is, in fact, of course, a large global contingent of banks that are very active in government policy and in actions around the world. So, yes, there's definitely an agenda by the private banking industry to take over and to expand itself. The global banking group is very active in creating public policy and in making things more expansive, making their control more expansive. So even though public banks around the world currently control about 25-30% of the deposits of the assets, they do unique jobs that private banks are not inclined to do, some of which include some of the, let's say, the transition to green energy or the investment in some of the new types of technologies or longer-term infrastructure development. One of the things that that is so desirable, in our view, about a public banking structure is that the money that is borrowed from our bank to serve our to develop some of these interests is retained by the locale or by the state or the municipality. Whereas when the bond market, hedge funds, and so forth get involved in investing in public-private partnerships in some cases, that money is often leaves town. We have here, I'm in the New Jersey, Pennsylvania area. Earlier this week, the Governor Murphy of New Jersey created a state bank implementation board, probably now taking one of the leading positions in the country about creating a new public bank. One of the reasons is that the billions of dollars that have left New Jersey to go to Wall Street banks, which are right across the Hudson River, are invested elsewhere. And the governor's intention is to retain the leakage of capital that goes out to the private banks by keeping it in his own public bank. Ironically, by the way, as a sidelight, Governor Phil Murphy used to be with Goldman Sachs. So it's quite interesting to see his initiative and his actually nation-leading initiative to create a state bank there.
Well, North Dakota Republican Senator John Hovind was previously the governor of North Dakota and before that the president of the Bank of North Dakota. You can find out lots of information that Walt McCree is talking about. Walt is a senior advisor for the Public Banking Institute. They have a website, publicbankinginstitute.org, where you'll see lots of videos, including one about the Bank of North Dakota. And you'll also notice that there are mentions of how public banks have worked in other countries, like some of the fastest growing economies in the world, China, Singapore, South Korea, have leveraged public banks, haven't they, Walt?
Yes, there are quite a number of banks around the world that are publicly owned, and as you mentioned, some of the ones, obviously they're big and small, from Ecuador and Costa Rica to China, Japan, Brazil, India, Russia, and so forth, and they all express a unique capability that governments have to increase the amount of money that comes into the economy, not contingent on the private sector for sustenance, for supply. Sovereign nations can, of course, create their own currency. And so in China, we see, and in Japan, we've seen a remarkable flexibility to be able to expand and recover in instances that, but not unlike, by the way, what happened in Grand Forks years ago during the fire and flood, when BND was able to be there and come in with immediate response to crises. Well, this is why I think public banking around the United States is growing, is that cities and states, which currently hold about have about $4.5 trillion of a market share in the private banking industry, that money is, you know, that's getting paid interest every year. Well, the desire to create public banks in these governmental entities is to retain that for all of the benefits. Germany, of course, has had public banks for a couple hundred years and has built a disproportional amount of its green generating capability out of the public banks they have there called the Sparkassen. The United Nations recently came out and said that we need to create more publicly owned banks in the world to be able to address the variety of issues that are coming forward on a climatological basis and perhaps a social basis as well. So I would say it's a growth industry. And in the United States, it's really getting quite a lot of attention by the governing executives.
Nevertheless, it's over 100 years ago the Bank of North Dakota was formed. There's only one such bank in the country at this point. Why do you think it's that 100 years after it started, it's the only one?
Yeah. Well, we have an 800 or 8,000 pound gorilla in the room, which is the private banking industry, which holds so much power over policy and also over discussion. And I think there's a certain amount of obfuscation that is done around banking by the banking interests, because it's a great franchise. When you look at how money is created, you realize that that's actually the provenance of banks. Most of our money is digital. About 97% of our money is on that basis, and it's created by banks when they make loans, unique to the banking franchise. So that while it's in some ways banks create, they create new money. So that is that's kind of a secret you don't want to let everybody else know about. But we now know that banks play that really critical role, that unique role, and so states and municipalities can also have that right. I just think that people haven't known too much about banking and paid too much attention to it. But since 2008, people have become newly aware of the private self-interest that is represented in that huge industry. And I'm talking about global banks, and again, not community banks and credit unions. They're not the problem. They are really the solution in many respects, as BND has demonstrated. There's a new awareness, and I think certainly a very extensive new drive to replicate the success that you guys have had, even though none of us can be North Dakota. You have a unique you have a unique economy there. You have wonderful collegial, familial side of relationships, and believe me, around the country, the opposition that comes up to the idea of giving legislatures a bank is typically universal. What? Are you crazy? You're going to give politicians a bank? Just because it works in North Dakota, you know, it doesn't mean it'll work here in New Jersey. Well, you guys set a wonderful example in that regard as well. And for sure, governance and management are key concerns as we're looking at creating new public banks.
How do you respond to the political argument that is inevitably out there that a public bank is a form of socialism?
Well, that was not really the impetus, was it? 1919, it wasn't done because of a socialist drive, even though the socialists were kind of on the horizon.
It was the Nonpartisan League. It was that time when North Dakota felt very isolated.
Absolutely. But the similarities are striking, because in many of the same ways the banks and the monopoly interests that were taking over North Dakota industry and resources and farms and houses, we see that operational today in the United States. I mean, many people, millions of people, lost their homes as a result of a banking stratagem which blew up the economy. We have students. I talked to students in New Jersey last week who are paying 15% to 17% on their student loans. Well, you guys are in at under 5. That in itself is just one example of what having your own bank can do. Now, it's really an American model. And by the way, politically, we see this on we have supporters from the far right and the far left. The Tea Party is actively supports this, and of course, the progressives also think it's great. Why? It's a great American tradition to be self-sufficient and to stand on your own and not to be abrogating power to either Wall Street or Washington.
And we've been talking about the State Bank of North Dakota, but this can be scaled, I assume, to be even a city bank, couldn't it?
Absolutely. Municipal banking is one of the categories of growth that we're working with, and there are numerous cities around the country who are involved. And just to mention a few of them, Philadelphia is on that, but also Seattle, Tacoma, in California, a new law was passed about 2 months ago, which codified creating municipal banks in California. So people are really onto this, and we're starting to learn about what works and what doesn't. It's still kind of an early in the process. We don't have a public bank yet to follow in your footsteps, but we're hoping to be the next bank in 100 years, the next public bank in 100 years, which we think will open up floodgates and also hopefully ultimately create a distributed network of public banks, which will empower that that sector of the credit architecture.
Well, this is an intriguing subject and one I suspect we'll be hearing more about. Walt McCree is the former chair of the Public Banking Institute, and he's currently the senior advisor for that organization. It's the publicbankinginstitute.org. That's the website if you want to find out more information, and there's a lot of information up there. But thank you for spending some time with us today.
Well, thank you very much, Doug, and I just want you guys to know that you are all the shining light on the hill that we constantly refer to, the Bank of North Dakota. So warm greetings to everyone there.
All right. Thank you, Walt. Coming up on Main Street, a Plainsfolk essay with Tom Ezern.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Starian Bank, celebrating 50 years of serving individuals and businesses in North Dakota, offering personal and business banking, mortgage, insurance, and investments, and striving to take their customers and communities farther. Learn more at StarianBank.com.
How good are your instincts for directions?
The more we use GPS, the more we become dependent on it.
Discover the benefits of finding your own way and get ready to explore the pilgrim trails of Italy.
It's about a 25-kilometer walk, and you hit all 7 of those churches. Quite an interesting walk in modern-day Rome, but touching on medieval and ancient sites.
On the next Travel with Rick Steves. Tomorrow at 8 Central, here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Tom Ezern is a distinguished professor of history at NDSU, a position that acknowledges his scholarship and influence. He shares his voice with us in the form of Plainsfolk essays, which are drawn from his knowledge and experience about the culture that distinguishes where we live. Today, he takes us behind the scenes a bit to remind us that, in the words of Shakespeare, past is prologue. Tom's essay is titled, The Rearview Mirror.
Some may say it is a sign I am in my dotage. But lately I've been thinking and writing more than ever about agriculture, farming and ranching. You see, I was never supposed to be a farmer. My eldest brother was that guy. And thanks to him and his capable wife and the others gone before them, as well as the cohort coming on, I believe I will see the family farm into the 7th generation. I grew up during the last picture show generation on the prairies. You may need to Google Larry McMurtry to get the reference I'm making here. The gist of it is, while the rest of the country was baby booming, the Great Plains were going into decline, economically and demographically. If you remember when the movie theater closed in your hometown, you know what I'm talking about. It was seldom possible for multiple children of a farm family to stay on the farm. Something else was in play, however. In 1980, the country pop singer Mac Davis declared that for his peers, happiness was Lubbock, Texas in the rearview mirror. It was the old story of rural-urban migration, with most of my generation rolling downhill to the city. Well, the objects in the mirror are closer than they appear. Perhaps they are not even behind me. I just signed a contract to deliver for a major publisher a chapter for a new book, A History of American Agriculture. My assignment, Agriculture on the Great Plains, in 8,000 words. The editor of the work is R. Douglas Hurt, another refugee of the last picture show generation who grew up about 70 miles from where I did. He, like I, was a 170-pound tackle on his high school football team, from which experience he moved on to a career in academic life. The book is one of those deals that will not be read much by the general public, but is intended to set the agenda for what historians will think and investigate about the subject. The influence will be indirect, but not insignificant. Doug says I am supposed to define the state of the field. There is a mantle of responsibility in telling this story. It feels like I should convene a focus group about the message, except I realize I've been doing that all my life. What to say? In the first place, in my history, our history, farmers will do things, not just have things done to them. They will do good things and bad things, smart things and dumb things, and there will be consequences, often unexpected, to deal with. For you history wonks, this is what is known as the doctrine of agency. In the second place, I will bring to bear some ideas not yet present in our historical narrative of the prairies. For instance, we have been living a story of climate change throughout the settlement experience on the plains, and never quite reckoning with it. In the end, my history of farming on the plains will not be confined to the rearview mirror, but will look around 360 degrees with the Great Plains in the center of time and space where they belong. I'll let you know how I think it's going, both as to the written history and as to the situation on the land. All good history, but especially agricultural history, has to be grounded.
That's Tom Ezern. Coming up on Main Street, Ashley Thornburg talks with naturopathic Dr. Ali Swamini about gluten intolerance, and we'll share an excerpt from a Prairie Pulse television show about behavioral health behind bars. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
I've been at this for 45 years. This is the absolute worst we've ever seen it on our farm.
Dan Youngren is president of the Red River Valley Sugar Beet Growers Association. He was among those speaking with North Dakota U.S. Senator John Hoeven and Minnesota Congressman Colin Peterson about this year's growing season and the role Washington can play in the aftermath. Youngren says when you talk about the losses, it helps to describe the scope and scale of what farmers are facing.
You know, just in the beet industry alone, we look at it nationwide, is that a mile-wide field, 235 miles long. That's how many beets are left in the field nationwide. That's from Fargo to St. Paul. It's huge.
Youngren says while Hoeven and Peterson are working to help farmers recover from a tough year, there is further need to find ways to add certainty to farming.
If we don't get it, I'm afraid that the word bankruptcy is probably going to get used more than we want it to. Just because people, A, for one, don't want to burn equity. Two, the young people are going to look and say, why should I come back? I don't want to lose money. I can go someplace else and make money.
Youngren says overall, farmers are looking to get money from the marketplace and not from the government. Grand Forks is looking to hire an engineering firm to help identify improvements that would alleviate flood threats to some Southside neighborhoods. The issue resurfaced in September when heavy rain sent water flowing through the streets and basements along Vale Circle, Glen Circle, and Westward Acres. Assistant City Engineer Mark Walker says the area sits about 2 feet lower in elevation.
Determined that this area could handle would be about a 1.1-inch rainfall event over a 24-hour period. A five-year event, for comparison purposes, is 2.9. What we experienced on September 21st, 5.4 inches over that 24-hour period. And according to the National Weather Service, that was the second highest since 1893.
Consultants in 2002 recommended nearly $16 million in upgrades to improve drainage in a much larger area, but residents felt potential damage was not worth the cost of the special assessments. The cost of the study could exceed $95,000. And the National Weather Service in Bismarck says much of the region should brace for significant impacts during a winter storm heading for the area this weekend. Ken Samosko is a meteorologist with the National Weather Service. He says while it is predicted this will be a significant storm, much of the details of specific threats have yet to be pinned down. What they can say is the greatest impacts of the system will occur Friday night into Saturday morning as heavier snow and stronger winds arrive, which could create some blizzard conditions.
So what are the impacts? Well, they would include things like closed roads, dangerous travel and driving conditions, power outages possible, commerce shutdown, and deaths and injuries. So those are things we're trying to minimize. The confidence is between medium and high. And the reason why that's not a high is because when you take a look at our hazard and our impacts, we have to kind of weigh those together. There's some things that we just don't know yet, which would be exactly where the heavy snow will occur, how much, what's going to be the range, where we may potentially see the blizzard conditions and possibly some ice.
Samosko says the specific elements of how severe the impacts will be and where will be refined as the week progresses over the next 3 to 4 days. He says the National Weather Service updates their website every 6 to 8 hours and is a good place to check for updates. As of right now, Samosko says much of the state will be impacted by the storm, but it's looking like areas south of I-94 may see the heaviest snowfall. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Naturopathy is a form of alternative medicine that advocates non-invasive treatment methods. For some people, what they eat can profoundly affect their well-being, and that can mean being very careful about what's in the food they consume. Naturopathic Dr. Ali Swabany recently visited with Ashley Thornburg about gluten intolerance.
Dr. Swabany, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Ashley.
One thing that gets tossed around a lot when we talk about diets is gluten. And people are in a camp that gluten is bad, always get rid of it. And other people are in the camp of gluten's fine. What's your problem? Where are you in this camp?
Yes, that's a great question. I would say I'm somewhere in the middle. I tend to think that for some people, gluten avoidance is a good idea long term. For some people, gluten avoidance short term is a good idea. For some people, it's not necessary at all.
Well, let me ask this. Is it gluten itself that's the problem, or is it the processing of gluten where something can become an issue?
So for some people who are, let's say, on the far end of the spectrum of intolerance to gluten,
like
have celiac disease, the problem for them is gluten itself, the actual protein in that grain. For other people, I think there is a major issue in the processing that we do in our country of gluten. That is everything from the growing and then the processing to make it into whatever it's going to be.
Yeah, we're bleaching foods, for example.
Right, and taking out this and adding in this. And, you know, it's not a whole grain anymore and therefore not as nature intended it, not as our bodies were intended to process it. So that is an issue for some people. Mm-hmm. I do, on that note, have a number of patients who travel to other countries in Europe, for example, and don't have a hard time digesting and processing gluten, where here in the United States they do.
Yeah.
So that's definitely the issue for some people.
Well, I've noticed that even with myself. I used to live in France and I've been back to Europe several times and I never have anything remotely similar to a gluten problem when I'm in Europe. But sometimes in the U.S. I get just kind of bloaty and maybe even a little headachey and I just don't feel good with some bread, some pasta.
Yes. And you know, we do have a tendency to process gluten in particular, but I guess many of our foods to the point of being close to not food anymore, close to not nourishing, nutrient-dense food anymore, but something else. And so to me, it makes sense that a lot of people have difficulty digesting that.
Well, and what are some of the signs if you are having difficulty?
So I think we need to kind of pull back and look at the picture, the big picture for a moment, which is, you know, it's really not just about gluten. It's about our ability to digest as a whole. And so some people who are having troubles digesting gluten might actually just have some digestive challenges that need to be remedied. Right. So they might have a lack of enzymes or hydrochloric acid, and that makes it difficult to break down not just gluten, but any food coming into the system. They might have an overgrowth of bad bacteria in their lower intestinal tract, and that makes it difficult to absorb the nutrients from their food. And so I do think gluten can get blamed for a lot of these issues because it is a bit more cumbersome to digest than some other foods. It gets the brunt of the burden of an unhealthy digestive
system.
It's
the stepchild.
Yes.
But back to the question, what are some of the possible symptoms? How might this be showing up if it is indeed gluten?
Yes.
Or any digestive concern, I guess.
Yeah. So some of the common symptoms I see are, you mentioned headache, digestive distress, whether that just be gas, bloating, diarrhea, constipation. It can go any direction digestively.
Good time.
Some people have more of the acid reflux type symptoms related to it. I have a number of patients who get extremely sleepy after consuming gluten, or even more of the mental emotional distress, like a more depression, anxiety piece if they're on it consistently. And then other common symptoms I see are achiness in general in the muscles and joints.
Okay. When you say depression in particular, or just any of the mental components, I really want to try to wrap my head around this. Are we talking almost omnipresent, or just like you have a slice of pizza you maybe shouldn't have because of gluten concerns and you just feel sad about it for like an hour? Or I assume there's a pretty wide range.
Yeah, that's a good differentiation to make. So for many people, that would be the case. I think of it for many people as you know, you might have something like a gluten hangover, right? Where for that day
pretty
and maybe
sure
the next, you might feel that things, you know, your mood has dipped. You're just not quite thinking as clearly. But then you think about the way the majority of our country consumes gluten, and that would be an everyday consumption, which would lead then to a more omnipresent symptom of depression, for example, or fatigue.
Okay.
So there is a place for healing up the gut, yes, but doing a trial off gluten for some people or testing for gluten sensitivity in some people if we aren't finding other sources of their symptoms.
Okay. When we talk about weight gain, it's so easy to say, oh, man, I turned 30 and then just all of a sudden I couldn't eat a whole pan of cake anymore. And, you know, yeah, you're not supposed to do that, whatever. But, you know, as a teenager, you can eat whatever, and it almost never shows up in terms of weight loss, weight gain, very strong metabolisms. Can your metabolism to gluten change?
Absolutely. And that has to do with digestive functioning. So what I see happen a lot is over time due to – so we tend to blame it on age, right? I mean, just as a culture. But over time due to poor eating habits and poor drinking habits, due to stress, medication use – there are – those are the things that are coming to the top of my mind. I know there are other factors. But due to these factors, our digestive processing slows down and we become more susceptible to the effects of some of the foods that are more difficult to digest. So gluten being one of them. We might develop something called leaky gut syndrome, for example, which is something we deal with a lot in the naturopathic practice, where the actual junctions between the cells – in our digestive tract become more leaky. So components of the food that we eat seep through into the bloodstream, seep through the lining of the large intestine into the bloodstream and become inflammatory in the body. So that can lead to symptoms like achiness, for example, in the joints. And that is not just because of the food itself, but also just because of that digestive processing being inadequate.
Are there things we can do to help increase that metabolic rate after it starts to drop, like a vitamin or changing the diet, or what would you suggest?
Yeah, there's a lot of factors involved. You know, we've talked about hormones some, you know, the thyroid hormone being part of it. So that's really important in metabolism. We've talked about toxins in previous segments and that toxic load is important in improving metabolism. We also want to make sure we have the nutrients our body needs to make energy. That's what metabolism is, really, is taking what we eat, taking what comes in, and turning it into energy. And how efficient are we at that?
Okay.
And so that metabolic process is about putting good things in. Mm-hmm. And getting the bad stuff out.
Your advice in a previous interview for setting yourself up for a healthy diet is to shop from the perimeter of the grocery store, basically just avoid the middle of the store. You also recommend eating organic and natural foods. Is there anything that would be specific to gluten intolerance that you'd recommend for diet changes?
Yes. I test everybody for food intolerances, almost everybody, because to me it's important to know what foods is your body not processing well. Those things are going to affect the whole picture of your health. So for some people, when I test that, gluten comes up. For some people, it doesn't. Some people notice effects from gluten. If they notice effects from gluten, I say avoid it for now. Let's heal up your digestive tract. Let's give your body what it needs, whether it be enzymes, hydrochloric acid, whether it be nutrients. And once we've healed you up, you may have more of a tolerance for gluten. You might be able to eat it.
It's almost like a sports injury, like take a break.
Take a break. Yeah. Yeah. That's a great way to put it.
Fascinating. Mm-hmm. So there can be baguettes and croissants in a person's life again.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think, you know, in moderation.
Oh, there's always that one. Dr. Swabney, thanks for your time today.
Thank you.
Main Street's Ashley Thornburg talking with Dr. Ali Swabney. Dr. Swabney is with Prairie Naturopathic Doctors in Moorhead. There are also naturopathic practitioners in Fargo and Bismarck. Next on Main Street, behavioral health issues behind bars.
Whether you're a sustaining member or you give annually or you've made additional contributions to Prairie Public, we thank you. Your generous support invests directly in the programs and services you and your community enjoy and depend on. Thank you, Prairie Public members. We're humbled by your trust.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Prisons and jails across the country face a challenge in dealing with behavioral health issues. In a recent Prairie Pulse television show, host John Harris visited with Julie Savat, the Clay County Jail Administrator, about the River Project, an effort to better address such problems. Here's a portion of their conversation.
You're here today to talk about, I think, what is relatively a new program in Moorhead called the River Project.
Mm-hmm.
What is that?
The River Project is a project that we have going on in our facility that we actually started this process a couple of years ago when we were building our new facility. We had a jail planning committee, and one of the things that we were concerned about is helping our individuals in our jail with mental health illnesses or issues. We see a lot of people coming through our jail every day with issues that, you know, we really needed to do something to help them so that when they left our facility, they were in a better place and they were better citizens for our community, and maybe they wouldn't come back again in the future. So if we could offer some tools, we thought, you know, we could better everybody. So for the new facility, we thought, let's build a behavioral health unit within the jail. And, you know, we really had a great feedback and input from everybody. And we came up with a couple things that we needed to do for this new facility. One of them was creating behavioral health in the jail that would have maybe Lakeland Mental Health come in and provide services for all of our inmates, training all of our staff in crisis intervention, and then actually building a unit within the facility that was targeted in a better location for people with mental health who have criminal charges. And with the great support of the county commissioners, they supported it fully, and we were able to provide all those services when we opened up in October 2018. And we have two full-time professionals coming in. It's actually four individuals. They split the time. They come into our jail Monday through Friday, and that's their job. Is they work with every inmate we have in there and providing all kinds of services.
Well, you mentioned services and programs or whatever. I mean, mm-hmm. Are there specific services? What are they for the inmates?
Yeah, we do quite a few different programs. We call it the River Project, and maybe I should explain why we call it the River Project. Mm-hmm. In our new facility, all of our housing units are named after the local rivers. We really wanted to have more community feel in our facility. It's Red River Block, there's Maple Block, there's Wild Rice, there's Cheyenne. And so since we're providing services for all our inmates and they're not just a targeted behavioral health unit, we decided to call it the River Project. So it helps everybody in the facility. So that's where the name came from, first of all.
What is MEND, M-E-N-D, I believe?
Yep. MEND is our medical provider for the jail. That provides us our doctors and our nursing and our health techs that are there Monday through Friday. And then on the weekends, we also have medical services. They also provide mental health services for us. They do ITV stuff. And they target more a different area than our River Project does. They do more of our suicide screens and medication maintenance.
Okay. Did you say ITV stuff?
Correct. ITV. That means they talk to the TV through a doctor.
Yeah, okay, yeah, it is.
They're not on site, they're through the television.
Okay. Well, yeah. When you say that, interactive TV, I just wanted to make sure. A lot of acronyms are thrown around. Why is mental health such a huge issue, and is it starting to be more accepted in terms of need to deal with?
I think it is. It's we see it every day, and we have seen it. We've always seen it, mm-hmm. But... You know, I think everybody's realizing that it's not somebody else's problem, it's everybody's problem. And so we need to come up with an approach that we can help people when we have them, even if it's a short period of time. If we can do something to help them, then they're going to be a better neighbor to you, they're going to be a better employee to you. I mean, it's important that we help everybody we can, and I think we're doing that with this program.
So really, how's it been going since about a year?
I think it's been going great. It's not only beneficial for the inmates, but it's beneficial for staff. Because when you have somebody who comes in who is difficult, the River Project can give you pointers on how to handle them, or they'll go and talk with them, because a lot of times they know these people. I mean, they're the same clients that they have are what we have. So, you know, they may have some history with them, and they can maybe get farther than we can with them. And, you know, they just provide that support that we need. We're very lucky to have them.
Can you tell us about maybe some success stories you've had so far?
Well, yeah, we've had many people who... We have seen out in the community who are continuing with their therapy. They have jobs. They have a place to live. They're maintaining sobriety. And, you know, that's a wonderful example of people being successful. So,
how about seeking safety? What does that mean?
Seeking safety is a program we offer that allows individuals who have been through maybe post-traumatic stress or trauma, and they find some resources of where to go to that is a safe place for them to talk to people.
you know, it helps them with counseling in those kind of areas where they may have been a part of some type of abusive or trauma type situation.
Now, you said how many inmates did your facility hold?
Well, we have 204 beds. Right now, when I checked this morning, we had about 130 inmates in there.
Yeah, 130. Mm-hmm. But do all inmates participate in some form of these programs, or do you just have a certain number that are participating?
So everything is voluntary. We don't make mm-hmm. anybody do anything. And we do separation by classification and gender. So the classes are typically small. So I might have more than one seeking safety in a week. I might have a couple, depending on who signs up for it.
Okay. I understand you also have, like, an anger management group.
We do. We have it's a program we offer that helps people come up with strategies and ways to control their emotions and identify triggers, possibly, that get them in trouble, and just learning different ways to handle situations so that maybe they make a better decision.
Okay. Yeah. You talked about it could be small groups. I think you also have individual therapy that you have offer.
Yep. We do offer individual therapy, and that can be for anything you need to talk about. And it's, you know, it's a private conversation with an individual counselor. It's not a group setting. And, you know, we can deal with anything you want to in those situations. And it's very easy to sign up. We have kiosks in all of our cell blocks. And anytime you want to talk to somebody from the River Project, you just put in an email request.
Is it your staff that's trained, or do you bring in outside staff for these projects?
All these projects are taken care of by Lakeland Mental Health.
Is it hard to train your staff to get up to speed on this project?
Not at all, because they've seen the benefits immediately.
Yeah.
Immediately, yep. The de-escalation tools they've been given, training with the CIT, and the people from the River Project have been so helpful and good to our staff, and they work with them. They're a team, and they're very happy that we have them in there.
So what kind of goals do you really have for it? Now that it's been going on for a year, you've mm-hmm. seen successes, what do you hope it does?
Well, I hope it can continue the funding for it, because the benefits are pretty amazing for the jail staff, but I'd like to expand it. We could actually use more. I'd like to see us get into chemical dependency treatment programs within the jail, and maybe offering a few more programs, more seeking safety, more anger management classes, things like that. The ultimate goal, I know, at one point was try to find a ability to divert people from the jail that maybe have a minor crime, but they are there because of their mental health, so they don't even come into the jail. So maybe in our pre-book, before they actually get processed in the jail, figure out if there's a better diversion program for them than to be in the jail.
What's a daily routine for your facility?
Well, there's nothing is ever the same, it seems like. Every day there's something new that happens. But, you know, you have your basic things that you have to get done. But in regards to programming, you know, we offer programming every day. And how we do it is basically through a kiosk. Inmates can request every day to sign up for something. And then we have specific program staff who will take them to and from programs and you know, make sure everybody's doing what they're doing and behaving and, you know, if you don't behave in a program, you know, there's consequences to that. So everything in our jail is behavioral-based, so we encourage good behavior. And the more program we can offer, I think the better inmates will have.
Well, Julie, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
John Harris with Julie Savat, Clay County Jail Administrator, in an excerpt from the Prairie Pulse TV show. You can see all the Prairie Pulse shows on the Prairie Public YouTube channel. Prairie Pulse airs Fridays at 7:30, and this week John visits with Devil's Lake native Mary Wakefield, who taught at UND and became the acting Deputy Secretary of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services in the Obama administration. We'll share a portion of that conversation on Main Street this Thursday. Dakota Datebook is next.
You can make a tax-advantaged contribution to Prairie Public from your IRA if you're age 70 and a half or older. To learn more, contact your financial advisor or call Troy Davis at 701-239-7510.
This is Dakota Datebook for November 26th. Thanksgiving is 2 days away, and many people are excitedly thinking of stuffing, turkey legs, and of course, mashed potatoes. Potatoes have always been a vital staple at Thanksgiving, and they were also one of the late Yogi Berra's favorite foods. And on this date in 1985, Berra received a special gift for Thanksgiving. Around 8 a.m., in freezing rain, a truck pulled up to his house, driven by two members of the Red River Valley Potato Growers Association. The truck contained 23 tons of North Dakota potatoes, which were unloaded in his front yard. How did the former Yankees catcher and manager end up with such a bountiful gift? Well, earlier that year, Berra showed up in Fargo to play in the Roger Maris golf tournament. Maris had been his teammate. As it turned out, Vince Lindstrom, the director of the Convention and Visitors Bureau, drove him from the airport to the hotel. On the drive, one of Berra's first comments was, "My God, it's so flat out here. What do you grow?" Lindstrom told him potatoes were a big crop. Berra's response, "You wouldn't have enough potatoes for my front lawn." Lindstrom said he would give Berra a sack of potatoes before he left, but that never happened. However, a few months later, he told the Potato Growers Association the story, and the farmers got to scheming. In a 2015 interview, Lindstrom told the Grand Forks Herald, "Somebody, maybe after a few drinks, said, 'Let's send a truckload of potatoes.'" And that's just what they did. The stunt attracted so much attention that New Jersey's former Senator Frank Lautenberg made an appearance at the scene, an episode that even became a question in Trivial Pursuit. However, Midwesterners are not known for being wasteful, so John Lindgren, Fargo's mayor, made a point to call a food bank in New Jersey to donate any potatoes Berra and his neighbors didn't want. As far as we know, all the potatoes made their way to someone's stomach, and even if they didn't, they surely made their place in history. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Lucid Thomas. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
On the next morning edition, a machine created to detect chemical weapons gets a new mission.
I'm going to go to the setting called Drug Hunter.
How it might prevent overdoses. Also, a new film explores African Americans' relationship with the police.
It's like America is beautiful, but it's also ugly because of our history.
The news and stories that affect your world on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Wednesday on Main Street, for more than 20 years, the Blender's Holiday Show has been a hot ticket, and we'll get a preview from Blender Tim Casper. Madeline will join us early this week to review two films, Parasite and Jojo Rabbit. Poetry from Studio 47 will feature Lydia Whirlwind Soldier. Sue Balcom will join us for Main Street Eats. And we'll have our What's Happening calendar of events a little early because it's the Thanksgiving week. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Wednesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.